The Tom Woods Show, episode 1894.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. I've got Jeff Herbiner with me today for a really important topic. Jeff is the chairman of the Department of Economics at Grove City College and one of the smartest people I know, honestly. His work is so important. And that brain of his, oh my gosh, I have not been able to stump this guy in decades of asking him questions. So what we want to do today is give an extended answer to a question somebody asked us during a live Q&A session. Jeff is a faculty member at the website libertyclassroom.com, which is my website where we teach what I call the history and economics they didn't teach you. And we've got all these courses, and you can consume them at 3 o'clock in the morning if you want. It doesn't matter. There's no set time. They're just sitting there waiting to be consumed. But we do a live event once a month where, we have the recordings, but it's good to be present there because you can ask your own questions. Well, I'll take a faculty member, and we'll take questions for an hour. So we did that recently, and we got some of the best questions we've ever had. And somebody asked a question I really, really liked involving something called Austrian business cycle theory. Now, this is really important because every time the economy turns down, there's always some reason that people want to blame capitalism or this and that, and that's why we need more regulation. We need to crack more skulls and all this. So it's very important to understand what actually does cause the boom-bust cycle in the economy. And somebody asked a really great question. Could you explain the Austrian theory of the business cycle to, let's say, a 5-year-old, maybe a 15-year-old, and maybe a graduate student? So what would be the different levels of explanation you would give? And I think in doing that, it will help us understand it better, and I think it'll help folks listening understand it better to see it at all these different levels of abstraction and precision. So we're going to dive into that now. Now, in case, as you're listening, the episode drifts into being too technical for you, just hang on. It's like an elliptical orbit. It's going to start coming back. Just when it's at its farthest point and you're giving up, it's going to start coming back towards you. So listen all the way through, and you will be amply rewarded with great intellectual pleasure. So with that, Jeff, welcome back to the show.
Well, thanks for having me on, Tom. It's a great pleasure.
It hasn't been that long since we last spoke. I was telling the folks that there was a particularly good question that was raised. I actually thought that the most recent Liberty Classroom Q&A session had some of the best questions, most interesting questions, and the most engaged group I've had in a long time, if not ever. And one of them had to do with the Austrian theory of the business cycle. And the question had to do with how you would explain it to people at different intellectual levels. Now, I've modified the question a little bit, but suppose you had to explain why there is a boom-bust pattern in the economy to a graduate student in economics. Okay, that would be probably the most advanced version. Then, by contrast, maybe to a precocious 14-year-old or something like that, a bright high school student, but still a high school student, and then maybe a 5-year-old child. Now, obviously, there are different levels of abstraction and detail that you would use in those different cases, but I actually thought this was helpful because of that old saying that you don't really understand something fully unless you can explain it to your grandmother, and I think this is an extension of that principle. So I think that's a principle that's very useful for Bitcoin, for example. If you can explain how Bitcoin works to your grandmother, then you've fully absorbed it. Until then, I'm skeptical. So here, I think it is useful. It's just a useful intellectual exercise, and I think the audience will understand it better if we run through it. And I can't emphasize enough the importance of this topic because, again, I keep emphasizing these days that I have a lot of new listeners because of COVID, and they came for COVID, and they stayed for the rest of Woods' propaganda. And I think some of these folks may be where I was before I encountered people like Jeff Herbiner. I thought capitalism's a great system, but you got to take the good with the bad, and it just has these downturns that are built into it, and there's nothing you could do about that. And we're kind of saying, not so fast. Don't sell capitalism short until you've heard all the arguments. And if you haven't heard the so-called Austrian case, then maybe you are selling it short. So let's go into it now. Now, which one of the, I think it makes probably the most sense, actually, to start with the most advanced. Although maybe I'm wrong, Jeff, but what do you think is the right method of attack here?
Yeah, no, I, I guess I thought of it the other way around. Sorry.
Did you?
Simple.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, maybe I'm more of a nerd on some level. I don't know, but okay. Yeah. Let's start, because I liked the way you were attacking it. So for those of you who have not heard this argument before, it's going to be intellectually liberating for you. But bear in mind that after you hear the 5-year-old explanation, you won't have all the details. It's true. But we're going to be groping toward that ultimate explanation. So what would be the way you would try to, of course, a 5-year-old doesn't understand what the economy even is. So it's a real challenge. What's your approach?
Well, I think the best approach with someone who's that young and, like you said, doesn't understand the economy or couldn't grasp, you know, even something as straightforward as a capital structure, is to use Mises's conception of the master builder. And so it'd be something like show a 5-year-old a completed 3-story house made of Legos or, you know, some kind of building blocks that the 5-year-old could manipulate. And then you'd give him, you know, a set of blocks to build another house, and you'd sort of stipulate that it needed to look like the one that you've already built. But then you would have like the evil Mr. Fed would come and try to convince the 5-year-old to build a bigger foundation so that, you know, you'd have a bigger, greater house, and then let the 5-year-old start that, you know, building it from a bigger foundation with the same number of blocks. And hopefully he or she would proceed. Maybe they'd see right away that they couldn't complete it, but if they tried, they'd proceed, and then they'd find that they couldn't, you know, finish all 3 stories. They'd get the second story or whatever. They'd run out of blocks. And then, you know, good Mr. Profit Loss would come and explain to the 5-year-old they need to tear down what he started and make it smaller at the bottom, and so he could complete everything.
All right. So that's a good thing. Now, it doesn't leave them with, this explains a lot about the macro economy. It doesn't, but but it's an exercise that they might remember in the future. And it gets them thinking in ways that are productive. Now, later as we proceed in this, because I can't improve on that for a 5-year-old. I didn't even think you could even begin the discussion for a 5-year-old. So I can't improve on that. But as we proceed in the level of sophistication, I want to go back and revisit what you just said about the 5-year-old, because I want to see exactly how does it manifest in the real world, this idea that there's, because it's not necessarily literally the case that somebody is literally building a house and he finds that in the entire society there aren't enough bricks to complete the house. There's something more subtle going on. So I want to make the analogy explicit when we get into the later stuff. But now let's move to, let's say, the 14, 15-year-old. Now here, my own approach would be something like this, which is also what I would say if I were under real time pressure. Maybe I had a TV spot and I had a time for a 15 or 30 second soundbite, and I have to somehow figure out how to do this in a way that will at least make somebody think and also make them realize there's obviously more to the explanation, but I had only the soundbite. So I sometimes, and I know it's not perfect, but I liken what happens with artificially lowered interest rates to what happens to the human body if you think you can nourish yourself entirely with energy drinks. That it is true that in the short run, you will generate more activity and you'll think, this is super and terrific, but you can't survive just on that, because you will crash. You will find that all of a sudden you need to, if you were genuinely trying to nourish yourself exclusively this way, you would find that you would need to take extremely long naps. You'd have to sleep a long time, so that would overcome whatever benefits you'd been getting from it would be swamped by the absolute exhaustion. So you would probably have just been better off not doing it in the first place, and just having a sustainable lifestyle where you work a certain number of hours per day, you have a certain amount of predictable output, stuff like that. So I would come at it with something that's familiar to them from their world, and something that they might even have experienced themselves physically. Now that's not the whole explanation, but that would be a piece of my puzzle. We can also use the master builder explanation as well. But what do you think about this as at least a first pass at the problem?
No, that would be an excellent way to get them to think about the sort of self-reversing aspect of the boom and the bust. Probably the 15-year-old could grasp some of the conceptual features of the actual process of the boom and the bust, at least a bright 15-year-old.
Yeah, because we've had bright 15-year-olds, so maybe not quite 15, but We've had bright high schoolers at Mises U, and I know they understand it.
Absolutely.
So maybe we should deal with the not-so-bright 15-year-old just to make it more of a challenge. So something like this.
Yeah.
Because I was thinking we could revisit the master builder example, but fill in some more blanks and explain things like what a recession is. The recession occurs at that moment when the master builder realizes that he has inadvertently embarked on an impossible project that he can't complete. And so the recession is not a bad thing. The bad thing was the time and resources and labor he wasted starting a project that couldn't ultimately be finished. That's a waste. Now he's got to knock all that down. You think of all the foregone opportunities for that labor and those resources and his time. That's all loss. That's just lost to us now. And so now he's got to reassess what is available, what is plausible, and start again. But we see that that's clearly the good part. That's the good thing. Obviously, we want him to build something that's sustainable. So it's not bad that the economy has the recession. That's the economy clearing out all the malinvestments from earlier. And then the other analogy we could make would be the Fed, evil Mr. Fed, is the guy who, just as the builder might be figuring out that he's doing something wrong, comes along and gets him intoxicated. And while he's intoxicated, he has this very optimistic outlook on life, as a lot of intoxicated people do, and he decides to persist in building this unbuildable house. So again, we look at Mr. Fed. Is he the good guy or the bad guy? Well, he's making the master builder persist in something that's not sustainable. How could that be good? So obviously, just coming along and doing artificial things to make the builder continue along a path that if he could see the world clearly, he wouldn't continue on, can't possibly be a good guy, can't possibly be the right thing to do.
Yeah, no, that's really great. I think that would be very instructive to an average 15-year-old. It's the key, really, that I think a 15-year-old can grasp that maybe the 5-year-old can't, is this self-reversing aspect, right? The sort of illusionary aspect that the entrepreneurs eventually wake up to and then see that they've made mistakes that have to be corrected. And it's the correction part that's improving efficiency and the stupor part of their building that created the malinvestments.
Right. Now, let's go now to a full exposition of the Austrian business cycle theory. And once we're done with that, I want to go back to our simpler renditions and explain what each thing represents. So I could do it, but what's the point of having a guest if I don't make the guest do the work? So Jeff, for the 1,817,322nd time, can you explain to people the Austrian theory of the business cycle?
Right. So the Austrian theory is theory of monetary inflation and credit expansion. It's the primary cause of the cycle. And what happens typically in our day and age, at least with a central bank engaging in buying securities from commercial banks, providing them with reserves, and then the commercial banks extend loans on top of those reserves that are not credit borrowed from savers, but are just created by the banks. And this extra credit then leads to suppression of interest rates and distorts then entrepreneurial calculation of the intertemporal allocation of resources. And the additional borrowed money will also lead to asset price inflation along particular lines of the boom, like in housing or automobiles or whatever it might happen to be. But the way in which the real resources in the economy get distorted is that they move from a sustainable pattern of capital structure, extracting raw materials out of nature, and then producing intermediate capital goods down through the stages of production to the production of consumer goods. And what happens when interest rates go down artificially like this is that entrepreneurs find greater profitability in building up assets in the higher stages, opening more timber cutting land in order to provide enough resources to facilitate the building of more steel mills and facilities and so on in the intermediate stages to eventually produce more consumer goods. But at the same time this happens, the lower interest rates also create a wealth effect for households in general who tend then, on the basis of rising housing prices that they own, will increase their consumption spending. And so resources are moving into both the ends of the capital structure, both into the higher stages and into the lower stages, which means that they're inadequate resources for the middle stages, And this is the master builder part of the actual explanation, that there are insufficient resources. And sometimes the claim is made, well, but that can be alleviated by the buildup of the assets that are being engaged in during credit expansion. But the problem with that, of course, is that the assets have specificity. They're being malinvested in particular lines. Too many iron mines are being opened up, and the mining equipment manufacturing is expanding too far to be sustainable. Those sorts of resources can't be used in the middle stages to make steel at a steel factory or to mill lumber at a lumber mill and so on. So it's this incongruity of assets placed in the intertemporal structure that creates the malinvestments. And then this all self-reverses in the crisis period, when the borrowed money that entrepreneurs are spending to build up their assets and households are spending to buy more cars and houses and so on and so forth, get paid out to the entrepreneurs who are producing these things, who in turn pay factory owners, and the workers who are earning this greater income don't save 100% of the increase in their income. They only save according to their time preferences. So all of the new money comes into the economy in the form of credit, and yet those funds get paid out to people in the form of income, and their time preferences are indicating that they're only saving, say, 5% of that income. So they only support the additional credit supply to a fraction, which means, again, that once their reallocation of income overcomes the Fed policy of credit expansion, the crisis comes and asset prices adjust, and stock markets crash, financial markets correct, interest rates go back up, and the whole structure of greater profitability for this lengthening out of asset investment into the higher stages proves to be unprofitable. And then we get the bust, where the whole process is reversed by liquidation, where the malinvested assets and the misallocated resources are sold by entrepreneurs in the boom lines to entrepreneurs who other lines of production, and reemployed in order to make the best use of the malinvested assets.
All right. Now, I'm going to call an audible here and insert a fourth level of explanation, but it's going to be somewhere between the 14 and 15 year old and the graduate student. So it would be a reasonably educated person without a lot of background in economics, so who might not know what the capital structure is or intertemporal allocation, stuff like that. So let me take a shot at this, and then you correct any inaccuracies in what I lay out. One way we can do this is by bearing in mind Roger Garrison's point, and maybe it's Hayek's point that he's just amplifying, that in order to understand how things go wrong, we first need to understand how they can ever go right. I think that is Hayek's point. So one way to do that is to think about what happens when interest rates are just determined by the market and there's no Fed involved. So if interest rates come down, or let's say the general public decides to save more, does not matter why, but the general public, their time preference is lower and they've decided to forego consumption for the time being and postpone it for the future. So the result of this, the objective result of this, is that interest rates wind up being lower than they would have been otherwise. So what does this mean? This means two things. It's going to have two effects. It means, number one, that people are going to be consuming in the future at a higher rate than before, because before they'd been consuming, they'd been focusing more of their consumption in the present. Now they may still, a majority of their consumption may be in the present, but they're postponing more of it than they had before. So that means that in the future, they'll be ready to buy goods that haven't been created yet. They'll be ready to buy them because they've saved the money for them. So entrepreneurs see this. They see that interest rates are lower than otherwise. And there's an array of projects that entrepreneurs could engage in. And the profitability of these projects is sometimes tied to how long the project is, how far away the project is from a finished good. So, for example, a bagel sitting in a bakery is, you know, practically in the consumer's hand. That's the lowest stage you can get to. But if we think about the farmer harvesting wheat, Well, that's very, very far from a finished, from a bagel that I can eat. So that's a higher order stage. Higher still would be research and development into new products that don't even exist yet. So the high, we have higher and lower order stages of production. Those higher order stages are could be 10 years before that stage ultimately yields us something consumable by the consumer. Could be even longer in the case of research and development. So research and development, then mining, natural resource extraction, manufacturing, and then all the way down, then transporting the goods from the manufacturer to a wholesaler, and then wholesaling to a retailer, then marketing is also a stage. And then eventually you get down to the finished product that the consumer buys. So you have the higher and lower order stages. Now, when interest rates are artificially low, you tend to be more apt to look at longer term projects because the interest rate sensitivity is much greater in those longer term projects. And you can see that in your own life. If, for example, you're thinking about your mortgage payment, you have a 30-year mortgage, and boy, it causes you pain every month to make that mortgage payment because you see how little of it is going to the principal and how much is going to the payment of the interest. If the interest rate comes down, if you refinance that house, the interest rate comes down, you'll notice that you're paying, if you don't lower your payment, if you keep paying what you had before, you'll find that more of it's going to the principal now and less is going to interest. That's an effect of how interest-sensitive higher order stages are. And not that your house is a higher order, but it's just that longer term projects are more interest rate sensitive. So here's what's going on. When interest rates come down naturally, this indicates the public is postponing its consumption. And it also means that now the entrepreneurs are going to shift resources now away from immediate consumption, away from, let's say, the retail store and more toward some new expansion of some new building or some longer-term project. And so let's say some of the trucking resources that might have been used to cater to the lower-order stages are released. They're not necessary right now because of consumer preferences. So now they're available for the use of entrepreneurs in the higher-order stages. And other resources, likewise, that are not being used in the lower-order stages are now freed up and available. So there's a coordination that takes place. There's a coordination in the sense that entrepreneurs are now aiming at the production of goods in the distant future, and consumers have indicated that they're saving and they're going to be consuming more in the distant future. So that works. And then secondly, because they've withheld some of their consumption in the present, then the immediate lower order stages that cater to that consumption don't need all the physical resources that they might need otherwise. And those are now available for use in the higher order stages. So again, there's coordination. But now if the Fed lowers interest rates artificially, well, that doesn't necessarily mean that the general public is now going to spend less and save for the future. It doesn't indicate that at all. What it does do is make entrepreneurs, again, more likely to invest in the higher order stages. But this time, the problem is that since people's consumption patterns have not changed, the resources that they expected to be available for the completion of their projects, they have to have a tug of war with them. With the lower order stages and the higher order stages. The higher order stages have to engage in a tug of war with the lower order stages. And given that the lower order stages are actually catering to real consumer demands and the real consumer pattern of consumption versus spending, the lower order stages are going to tend to win. And so instead of a nice coordinated process, you have disruption, you have discoordination, you have a configuration of resources across the whole economy that in the long term is not sustainable. Something's going to have to break apart here. And that's where you get the recession. Now, I fear that I may have oversimplified things or something here. But again, remember, this is for the adult without an economics background, but who just wants to get the general picture. What would be your comment on the way I just laid that out?
No, I think that's excellent, Tom. I think that's exactly right. You just have to show the discoordination that exists in the whole harmonization of production processes. And that can be done, in more sophisticated and less sophisticated ways. Yeah. So, no, I thought that was very good.
Okay, good. Okay. So now let's go back to the 15-year-old. Oh, let's go back to the 5-year-old with the house, with the foundation that's too big so we can't complete it. How in the real economy, using an actual flesh and blood example, might you be able to illustrate how that is actually at work? Because the house represents the entire economy in that metaphor. It represents the entire, we're not really talking about a home builder building a house and he doesn't have enough resources to complete it. He's building too big of a house. We're talking about an economy who, in the aggregate, has become too ambitious because it thinks more can be done than can actually be done. It thinks more saved resources are available than are actually available. So how would we see that working out in the real world? In the metaphor, we see that, you know, one day the builder looks and realizes, wait a minute, there's no way I can finish this house. What does that look like in the real world?
Well, I think it occurs in this correction of asset prices, in the profitability that the entrepreneurs are anticipating, first with respect to their, you know, the Fed's induced suppression of interest rates. As you were explaining before, this just alters the profitability calculation of higher stage investments. And the entrepreneurs individually, of course, are not thinking about the macro economy aspects of the capital structure as a unit. They're just thinking about their own business activity within the complementary stages where they're engaged in buying and selling things. So their focus is just on that. And so they're misled by the greater profitability that's created through the monetary inflation and credit expansion. And what happens, it isn't that they suddenly realize that there's a physical resource constraint. What happens to them is that they eventually come to be aware of the fact that the lines of investment that they've engaged in, any additional expansion in those lines will prove to be unprofitable. So let's say they have a timber plan that opens up in order to provide more lumber for lumber mills to feed the housing boom. So this goes on for a few years where these timber companies are opening up another area of the forest and then another one and then another one and another one. And pretty soon they're engaged in less and less profitable extensions of greater resource use in these areas and go to the best forest areas first and exploit them and then the less accessible ones and the ones where they have to build more roads in the forest and so on and so forth. And it becomes ever riskier then and ever less plausible that even further extension will prove to be profitable. So some of the more savvy entrepreneurs simply realize that they've extended, overall as an industry, they've extended the exploitation of these resources to the extent that it's becoming extremely risky of a downturn in housing affecting the demand for their timberland activity. And so they begin to sell out. And when the savvy investors sell out, the prices of those assets begin to soften. And then less savvy investors notice this, and they too reassess and question whether or not this extension of investment will all pan out in a profitable way.
Hey, folks, it's May, and that means summer is approaching rapidly. Well, enjoy the summer without a looming to-do list. And one way you can do that is by crossing getting life insurance off that list. And of course, as you know, if you have anybody who relies on your income, you need life insurance. And Policy Genius makes it so easy. You can compare quotes from over a dozen top insurers all in one place. And let me tell you what that actually means practically. It means you can save 50% or more on life insurance. That's what comparing quotes does for you. Now, what does that mean? What does 50% or more mean? It means you could save $1,300 or more per year on life insurance just by using Policy Genius to compare policies. And the licensed experts at Policy Genius are working for you, not the insurance companies. So you can trust them to give you unbiased advice and navigate you through the whole process. And it's so easy. Just go to policygenius.com. And in just minutes, you'll be working out how much life insurance coverage you need, and you'll be comparing personalized quotes to find your best price. And when you're ready to apply, well, the Policy Genius team handles all the paperwork and scheduling for free. They never sell your information to other companies. They don't add on extra fees. There's no reason not to do it. So head to policygenius.com to get started right now. Policy Genius, when it comes to insurance, it's nice to get it right. One other thing I want to say here. It's interesting that it's true that artificially lowering interest rates does generate some economic activity that wouldn't have occurred before. But obviously, this is not the end of the discussion because it's not a good thing for this particular kind of economic activity. So it's not enough to say that a lump of activity is occurring. What matters is that it's the right kind of activity, that it's a kind that can be sustained, a kind that is in line with resource availability and people's consumption and saving preferences and so on. But it's as if, frankly, everybody other than the Austrians is just thinking in terms of numbers and aggregates. Oh, well, now there's more activity. But okay, but activity per se is not what we want. And likewise with fiscal stimulus, when the government just spends a lot more, borrows, let's say, and just spends a lot more, and they call that fiscal as opposed to monetary stimulus. Again, there the thought is it doesn't even matter what we spend the money on. We just want to stimulate resources back into use. But again, that's not really the issue. And anyone could do that. I mean, I could put a gun to people's heads and say, you have to use this crane. You know, you have to use this or that. But what the entrepreneurs are really doing at that time is figuring out, frankly, the repricing of resources. After there's been these artificial booms, the entrepreneurs then have to figure out, okay, what should everything actually be priced at? What makes sense here now? What projects are really profitable now that we know the true conditions? And so they're trying to figure that out. And just simply getting a bullhorn and saying, all right, everybody, you now have to start using resources again because then we'll get some activity going, is just seems to be completely tone deaf as to what the problem is. So am I just misunderstanding them? They can't be incapable of understanding that what we're dealing with are micro level problems of this particular industry shouldn't have expanded this much, or this particular, it can't just be that they're thinking, well, at least everybody's working. I must just be missing something.
Well, unfortunately, Tom, I don't think you are actually missing anything. At least if we go back to the graduate level or the university level treatment of macroeconomics that is non-Austrian, their models just don't have a capital structure in them. They actually do think this way. And they therefore think that any economic activity that adds to the lump of economic activity must be economically viable and a good thing. The macro dimension of their modeling is almost completely divorced from the microeconomics, which, you know, particular things, as you say, particular allocations of particular resources. And as you were describing before, the steps of the process of providing successful, integrated, sustainable production processes from research and development all the way down to production of consumer goods.
Well, this is another reason for people to be interested in the Austrian school. Number one, because it is telling you things that are true, but also just this idea that we're talking about the real world of real flesh and blood human beings, not aggregates, not gigantic numbers, but real flesh and blood human beings making discrete decisions under conditions of uncertainty, and what they do in cases when the uncertainty is, or the difficulties any entrepreneur has in exercising his judgment and trying to figure out what resources ought to be combined in what way and to what end, when the Federal Reserve, in this case, throws a lot of white noise into the background. And we see the results of that. Now, there are many other things we could say about this. We could obviously spend a great deal of time on this because there are objections that you could raise. Like, for example, why don't entrepreneurs figure this out after a while and not invest during a boom? And there are answers to that. And now that I've said it, let me just say in parentheses, there are a few ways that this has been attacked. One is to say, well, that's easier said than done. It's not like if I just, let's say I took away all prices of all goods and I said, oh, come on, entrepreneurs will just figure that out. Well, entrepreneurs are very clever, but they're not infallible, or they're not wizards. They do need some things in order for their calculations to have any resemblance to reality. Another approach is to say that if they see all their competitors engaging in expansion of their enterprises under the conditions of artificially low interest rates, well, they've got to take part in that too, or they're just going to get left behind, and they got to just hope that, you know, what they do winds up surviving the bust. And then another way would be your former student at
Lucas
Kent
Engelhart.
State. Yeah, Lucas Engelhart has an article on how it's not that the manipulation of interest rates makes entrepreneurs foolish and do foolish things. It's that it makes fools entrepreneurs. That under these boom conditions where, you know, loans are being extended at the drop of a hat at super low interest rates, well, any old idiot thinks he can just hop in there and make a fortune, and that itself becomes a problem. So there are a number of ways of addressing that. Maybe because I I said I wasn't going to go down this road. Now here I am. What's your, I feel like the classical description of the Austrian business cycle theory involves entrepreneurial error. It involves the idea of error, not just, well, we know everything is going wrong and we know this is unsustainable, but, you know, we can't let the Acme company do all the expansion during this time, so we better just roll the dice and hope it works out for us. That could be, but I don't think that's the way Mises thought of it.
No, Mises thought that, I think he relied upon what we might call just a division of labor among entrepreneurs. That there's a variation. They too are not a lump, right, of equally capable individuals, but they form their expectations as individuals. And therefore, there's going to be variation across all individual entrepreneurs, even in the same industry, they're all making expectations. And because they form expectations as individual persons based upon their own judgments, there's going to be this variation. So there's going to be a demand, in other words, for credit, let's say, in a particular industry, and it's going to slope downward to the right, even if each individual entrepreneur isn't like in lockstep in wanting to borrow more at lower interest rates. But if interest rates are lower, there'll be some entrepreneurs who will, in fact, borrow the additional funds and expand, you know, the projects. So I think it's just built into the variation of human persons that we would also say is just part of the normal or typical explanation of the division of labor.
I think we'll leave it there. We've given people enough to chew on. What I'm going to do is on the show notes page, tomwoods.com/1894, I'm going to link to a couple things. One, I'll link to that that collection of essays, that classic collection of essays, The Austrian Theory of the Trade Cycle and Other Essays. And you can read some of the classical expositions of the theory. The Rothbard one is particularly accessible to read. I'll also have maybe a 10-minute video. It's extracted from a longer video I did some years ago on the Depression of 1920 to 21. And somebody, which has had probably 250,000 views at least by now, but somebody took out just the portion where I talk about the business cycle, and I think it's like 10 minutes. And I'm going to put that portion of that video up on the show notes page as well. Is there anything else that you would recommend on this particular topic to somebody who's just getting started in it, other than something like that collection of essays?
Well, obviously there's Meltdown.
Yeah, I guess my own book. Okay, I'll link to Meltdown. I did actually explain the theory in that book too. Thank you, Jeff. All right, so we'll put Meltdown on there also. Well, listen, congratulations on completing what I'm sure was rather a harrowing academic year this year. I know you've got final exams coming up and then you're all finished, so I hope you have a really productive summer, and I look forward to seeing you at least briefly at the Mises Institute this summer.
That'll be great, Tom. I look forward to it too.
Okay, everybody, two announcements before we get going. Number one, it is not too late to sign up for John Bush's really important crypto and privacy event that he's doing online. It's a great weekend course, and it's going to take you from crypto curious to crypto confident. A lot of folks are interested in cryptocurrency, but they do not know what the first steps are. They don't know how to hold and keep securely their crypto. And they hear all these stories about, well, I lost $1 million worth of crypto because I lost a password or something. They don't know what to do and they don't know where to look. And John's going to walk you through all that stuff. He's going to talk to you about how to multiply your crypto. And he's also going to spend some time talking about internet privacy, because we always think about that too, right? We know we're being snooped on, but I don't know how to fix that. And I mean, it's probably a big pain in the neck and whatever. But I don't know. Maybe we should be doing that. And John knows all about this stuff, and he's going to include a bonus section on that too. Now, I've known John Bush since the Ron Paul days of 2007, and don't be deceived by the fact that he looks like he's 12. That's just because, I don't know, he found some fountain of youth. I don't know what the explanation is. When I knew him, he looked like he was 10, all right? So he's aged about 2 years in the past 14, but he's got the knowledge of somebody twice his actual age, let's say. So he's definitely somebody who's conscientious, honest, reliable, somebody to learn from. So the website is cryptoandprivacy.com. I want you to go check that out, cryptoandprivacy.com. You can always watch the recordings, but you're going to have a great course that you can enjoy in real time and that's going to benefit you in very practical ways. So Go do that as soon as possible. CryptoAndPrivacy.com. The second announcement is for anybody who has somehow managed to miss this. I put it on Facebook. I put it on Twitter. I put it on MeWe. I put it in my newsletter. I put it on this podcast. But I want to remind you that the 2000th episode of The Tom Woods Show is coming up October 16th, 2021, and it is going to be an absolute blast. It's a live event in Orlando with a lot of your favorites from The Tom Woods Show, and we're just going to have so much fun. Okay, there'll be an absolute, learning will be kept to an absolute minimum at this event. It's just going to be a celebration of normality with a whole bunch of people. It's going to be a big, big crowd, a whole bunch of people who don't think you're crazy, who think the Faucis of the world are crazy. And we're just going to enjoy each other's company and the entertainment that I'll be giving you throughout that night. Doesn't cost you a thing to attend. It costs nothing. This event is my gift to you. We're holding it at a beautiful luxury resort. It does not cost you a thing to attend. What I would like you to do, however, is register to let me know you're coming. And you can do that at TomWoods2000.com. So again, it's not TomWoods.com/2000. It's TomWoods2000.com. So go do that, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of The Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.